Once more under the breach, dear friend. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. And Jake is not with us today, and I need to speak to the engineer and say I've got a heck of an echo here. So whatever, there you go. That's much better. Thank you. Nothing like hearing oneself to cause a lot of confusion. Well, my name is Jeff McClure, and this is The Personal Wealth Coach, and we are going to make a valiant attempt to have a radio program today, presuming that I can get things to work correctly. Which may or may not be the case, depending on what does work correctly and what doesn't. We got an engineer in here today, and he claims to be... Do you claim to be an engineer? You can turn your mic on, by the way.
I believe we had this conversation off mic last week. I do not claim to be an engineer, okay, well, because I do not conduct a train.
So you're a board operator.
I am a board operator today, yes, sir.
So you're really bored, and you're an operator.
That about sums it up.
All right, that's good. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We have a board operator and a anything-but-board advisor... investment advisory representative of the Personal Wealth Coach here. Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this, at least for me, rivetingly, fearfully exciting opportunity to talk to two hours to a foam ball and try to sound interesting. It is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business all over the place with a lot of people. We manage investments for people with higher net worth, and we're what's called a family management organization. And it kind of overlap, except that what I'm going to be presenting to you on the radio today is not investment advice, which is what we dispense. It's rather educational information. And there's a big difference. Educational information is general. Investment advice has to be specific, has to be objective. So, what else do I need to disclose here? I need to disclose that the information that we or I will present on this program is not guaranteed to be accurate, but has been obtained from sources that we believe and deem to be highly reliable and properly authenticated and all that other kind of stuff. In other words, we do our best to avoid fake news in any form or fashion. Apparently, we have a caller on our telephone number. Telephone number in here if you'd like to join with me this morning on the Personal Wealth Coach, and I would encourage you to do so. Your questions are what I'm going to keep my defibrillate my brain, at least I hope that, would be 254-773-1400. And Raymond in Temple is on that number right now. So, Raymond, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I was wanting to ask you concerning silver certificates. As far as a silver certificate, they come in all different denominations of currency. Does that mean that the higher the denomination of the currency, it's worth more than the other, or it just depends on how old they are? You have a good day.
All right. Well, there's some degree of collector's value in a silver certificate today because they haven't been issued since the late 1960s. But as far as their actual value as money, they have exactly the same value as a Federal Reserve note dollar that you carry around, or a $20 bill or whatever. You can no longer take a silver certificate to the bank and get silver. Before, I think it was 1971, you could literally take a silver certificate dollar bill to the bank and exchange it for a silver dollar. Which really was interesting because the silver dollar was rapid. That's one of the reasons we got off of it, is the silver value in a dollar, which I think recently was like four. I don't remember. I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but it was $14 a while back. The silver price was higher than the dollar price. And actually, the people who helped blow two things helped blow silver certificates out of the water, if you will. One was Charles de Gaulle, who took the fact that theoretically U.S. money could be exchanged for gold. It represented gold and silver at 35 to 1, $35. Gold was $35 an ounce, and silver was $1 an ounce, and it was a very artificial price set up in Bretton Woods and enforced by the major economies in the world the major nations in the world after World War II. And by the way, during that time period, it was illegal to own gold other than in the form of jewelry, because they didn't want people trying to play around with gold. Well, as we went off of the gold standard, and we went off the gold standard because Charles de Gaulle decided that he was going to get even with us for what happened in World War II, and we had used him as a conduit to funnel false information to the Nazis, because we realized his organization in England, his government in exile, was leaky as a sieve, and anything that was given to them went straight to the Nazis. And we told him that we told him we were going to invade through at Calais, and he was proclaiming an invasion in Calais, and then we didn't include him in the invasion planning. So he decided to get even with us by dumping a bunch of dollars on the United States and saying, "I want gold." Well, it would have significantly depleted our gold reserves, because we had issued a lot more dollars than we had gold, which is the way we are today. People who want to go back on the gold standard don't get it. There's not enough gold in the world to represent the money that's in the world. There's not even enough gold in the world to represent the dollars that are in the world. So President Richard Nixon did what is now very popular, which is by executive order, took us off the gold standard. And in doing so, he also, one of the parts of going off the gold standard is the silver certificate could no longer be exchanged for an ounce of silver. So they have some, if you have a pristine silver certificate, it has collector's value, and I have no idea what the current market is for silver certificates, but it has no more purchasing regular value than does a regular Federal Reserve note. Matter of fact, I would consider the Federal Reserve note to be more authentic and more reliable than a silver certificate. So that was good. Thanks for the call. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. I guess I better start with, if I can find here, what happened in the market this week. We're going to stick to the S&P 500 as our example of the market. It's 500. Basically, the S&P 500 stock index is around 500. I think it's 505 stocks in it right now. And they have to be relatively large companies. So basically, it's pretty close to being the 500 largest publicly traded corporations in the United States. When we say largest, we mean largest in the sense of their total value on the market is the largest. And it occupies, that's probably in excess of 80% of the total value of the market. Once we get down into the mid-caps, those are large caps. Mid-caps are in there, and some of them are not in there. Many of, and so the big market movers and the vast majority of value in the publicly traded market is in the S&P 500. Anyway, the S&P 500 dropped 1.61% this week. It ended at 2637.27. Now, some of you may remember a while back, and I think it's ironic that we mentioned this on the program, it hit 2929 at one point on a Friday at the close, and I said, that's a good number to remember. It's a, you know, 2929, yeah, I can remember that. That's a good one. It's kind of like the fact that the bottom of the stock market, the bottom of the S&P 500 in 2009 was 666, and which really, and then if you can also, that was where it touched bottom during the day. It actually closed that day at 676. But those are good mnemonic numbers that you can remember to say if the market high or low. So low, really low, would be 676 on the close. And the highest it got, and it was, we mentioned it was 2929. It was a mnemonic that is easy to remember. It also happened to be the highest close we've ever had. And from there, in late September, it has bumped up towards that number and then slid back down and bumped up towards that number and slid back down and continued on down. Well, it's at 2736, which is not that far down from there. Particularly in light of the fact that on Thursday it hit 2674, so it actually rose 2.32% from midday Thursday until the end of the day Friday, which is good news, and I like the good news. It's down 1.61 for the week, and that's 6.6% down from its high on September 26th. And for the year, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is only up about 2% from the beginning of the year. It's about 6% up from where it was last year. But unless we get a major rally We're going to see that 1 year as we slide towards the end of the year. We're going to see that 1 year number decline pretty substantially. And I don't really see a major stock market rally in the cards at this point. Always a possibility at the end of the year, it's a technical issue, that the stock market could put in what's called a Santa Claus rally. And it has to do with a lot of people shuffling money around at the end of the tax year as December rolls in. We'll see what happens there. There's an irony, but there's an indication that it may not happen this time. And the indication is pretty simple. As earnings reports have come in, and on average for third quarter, which is what the earnings are being reported for right now, we're seeing earnings up 22% from last year. But the market's only up about 6%. And you might say, wow, that doesn't make any sense. Well, actually, it does. It makes a lot of sense. And it's that slides over into issues of the economy at this point. See, the big box retailers, you know, Target, Walmart, and so on, or as I used to say, Target, reported earnings this week. And they tend to cluster together by industry. And literally every one of them except JCPenney, which is sliding into oblivion following Montgomery Ward and Sears, the old big box stores, the old anchor stores in the malls are all sliding away into oblivion. Although I might say Macy's turned in a really good 14% increase from last year. But these companies, the big box stores, all except JCPenney, which really isn't a big box, came in with earnings reports for the third quarters above expectations. Now, expectations means what did they give guidance for earlier combined with what did the analysts on Wall Street say they expected to see out of these companies. And that generally kind of sets the price. Historically, when companies come in and beat earnings, in other words, they come in and say, instead of a 14% rise in earnings year over year, what we're going to report to you is that we had a 20% rise in earnings. And that's pretty typical. That's what we've seen. And every one of their stock prices went down anywhere from 5 to 15% after they reported more earnings than were expected, which to a person who doesn't follow the markets and doesn't follow the economy a lot looks crazy. I mean, their earnings went up, which means their price-to-earnings ratio went down, which means the stock should be worth more money, and immediately it falls. There's a couple of factors here. One is there's an old saw on Wall Street. It's called buy on the rumor and sell on the fact. And that's exactly what was going on here. But here's the key. This ties into the other things I want to talk about today. The earnings reports up on average of 22% from last year. Wow, that sounds really impressive. It sounds like everything is on a tear. And in a sense, it is. But at least 12% of that 22%, in other words, 10% is real, 12% is false. And when I say false, I don't mean false in the sense that somebody made it up or it's fraudulent. It is simply because of the corporate tax cut. In other words, if we look at last year when corporate tax rates were in the upper to mid-30s, and this year, when corporate tax rates are 21%, that's a heck of a jolt for businesses. So if a company came in and, for example, reported, as I mentioned, reported 14% increase in earnings, and 12% of that increase in earnings, everybody who really knows this recognizes simply the tax cut, well, there's not another tax cut coming, thank God. Which means their real increase in earnings was only 2%. Now, even though the stock was priced on somebody saying, well, we only thought they were going to get 12% and they actually got 14%, the reason that the stock prices fell was generally this: the forward guidance from the CEOs who made the earnings reports. They make this via a conference call. Uniformly is down from where it was last year. In other words, last year, even before they knew for sure at this point we were going to get the tax cut, the guidance was for dramatically increased earnings in 2018. And we got the dramatically increased earnings in 2018. Plus, we got a big tax cut, which really supercharged the earnings. And we're going to get into the effects of that tax cut in just a minute. But the way this was presented and the way it works out is the people who are in major institutional investors, and that's the ones who tend to move these stock prices and move the S&P 500, took a look at all of the numbers and realized we saw a surge in earnings for the company because they got a tax cut. We saw a surge in purchases, and that surge in purchases equates to the tax cut that consumers got. In other words, consumers got a tax cut too, and in many cases you didn't notice you got a tax cut unless you go back and very carefully compare your numbers with the previous year's numbers. But a lot of consumers got a tax cut too, and they have been spending that money. As a matter of fact, they spent in the last quarter, they actually spent a little more than they got. Their savings rate dropped off a little bit, and their credit card debts crept upward. And the investors took a look at that and say, that's not sustainable. That ain't going to work. And then the other thing they're taking a look at is corporate debt. Corporations uniformly have debt, or they will go out of business pretty quick, because they got to have, that's part of the way any economy works. For example, a young family that doesn't take on any debt won't ever get a house, and they won't ever buy a car, except maybe a junker, and it's going to be really, really hard for them to get ahead. So you take out a mortgage, and you borrow money to buy a car, and you go forward. In many cases, those loans are fixed, and therefore the capital life of the whatever it is that you're buying, and they're really, really good things, and corporations do the same thing. The problem is that a lot of corporate debt rolls over from month to month. And when it rolls over, if we get a rise in interest rates going forward, that debt becomes more expensive, and so it cuts into their earnings going forward. Secondly, the current consumer buying boom that occurred this year, which has run inflation up to 2.5% now, we got a report this week from the Census Bureau, that the consumer price index year over year rose 2.5%. Now we can there's some nitpicky things inside of there that are important, but wages are up 3.5%, consumer prices are up 2.5%. So the worker got ahead, and that sounds like it's really good. The worker had 1% more money to spend, largely because of the tax cuts again, and also because of the labor shortage. And the consumer went out and started spending that. Well, I reported a little while back in our newsletter, and I think I mentioned it on the radio, Procter & Gamble, which is in many ways the bellwether for the economy, because they make so many basic items that you buy in the grocery store that you need. I mean, you do need laundry soap, and you do need hand soap, and you do need deodorant, and all that stuff that Procter & Gamble makes is really boring, is really fundamental to what's going on in the economy. And Procter & Gamble raised prices across the board recently. And after they raised prices across the board, lo and behold, shockingly, they saw their sales increase. Now, they've been lowering prices for some time because we've had a de facto deflation, and they've been inching their prices lower and by having sales and having coupons and doing whatever they could to try to support things. They raised prices and saw their sales increase. Now, that sounds like a wonderful thing until you realize that means that the consumers who are buying the Procter & Gamble's stuff in the grocery store had more money to spend and were comfortable with buying, and their perception was higher price means higher quality. Well, short term for Procter & Gamble, that's a winner. From the viewpoint of the Federal Reserve, that's a big loser. That means that the consumer has now internalized the issue of rising inflation and expects prices to go up and will reward companies who raise prices. That's a spiral that can be really, really, really uncomfortable as those of you who lived through the 1980s and remember it, those five or six of us that left in the world who did that. The issue is that once inflation gets set in people's mind as a reality and they come to accept it and expect it, they have a tendency to do two things. They have a tendency to buy early and to borrow to buy. Let me say that again. They have a tendency to buy immediately before the price goes up, and they have a tendency to borrow from their future income to make that purchase. When I say borrow from future income, Ed was talking about that on the last program when he was talking about if you are headed in, if you're in a situation where bankruptcy is an option for you, which is the people he was talking to, it's because you borrowed from your future to the point where you can't afford to pay anymore. And that puts you in a world of hurt. And there's the way, what the kind of Chapter 13 bankruptcy he's talking about is borrowing more from the future, but in having basically a court-imposed and a market-imposed restriction on any more borrowing until you dig yourself out of the hole. That, by the way, is the United States economic cycle. So let's come back to why all this stuff and all these issues of earnings and all of this are not particularly good news, even though on the surface it seems like good news. And the answer is that the Federal Reserve is going to need to raise short-term interest rates to head off inflation, and is near certainty at this point among economists that in December, when the Federal Reserve Board meets, they're going to raise rates from the current 2.5%. And I realize it's 2.25 to 2.5 to a range of 2.5 to 2.75. Now, I'm going to use the higher number, 2.5 in this case, and there's a reason for that. Within the market for short-term government debt and short-term debt in general, when the Federal Reserve says 2.25 to 2.5 is the range, their targeted range, it tends, the actual interest rates that the market then generates in short-term debt tend to be somewhere in that range, and they have been pushing the upper end of the range hard, so that the effective short-term rate right now is 2.5. Now, when interest rates are coming down and the Federal Reserve is trying to compensate for the fact that we're headed into a recession, if they had 2.25 to 2.5, the trading out there would be around 2.25 because the economy was slowing down and it was a slowing demand for debt, short-term debt in this particular case. We have an increasing demand for short-term, long-term, and intermediate-term debt that's going on right now, so interest rates are going up. And the Federal Reserve is in the awkward position, contrary to what the president seems to think, of trying to keep up with the markets. In other words, the markets are raising interest rates. The 10-year Treasury note is the benchmark for interest rates across the economy. Now, depending upon riskiness and a whole series of other things, a given bond may be more or less than that, but it's the benchmark, and it generally stays constant relative to that 10-year note. In other words, a certain percentage differential is built into every other bond that's out there. And the 10-year Treasury note interest rate is 30% higher today than it was a year ago. Now, we kind of tend to project these things into the future. A 30% increase in interest rates over the next 12 months would be pretty darned impressive. We got, in other words, we have around a 3.1 something. I've got that in here. Let's see here. If I can find where I put the U.S. 10-year note, was a 3.067. Now, it actually was up around 3.2 earlier. But even a 10% rise would be 0.3. A 20% rise would be 0.6. A 30% rise, obviously, would be 1.8. So you'd have, if the Federal Reserve, not the Federal Reserve, but the markets continue to push interest rates up, the 10-year note at the same rate we've seen over the last 12 months, then the 10-year note will be around 5% next year. And that is, that's really pretty impressive, as it'll be pushing in the upper fours, headed towards 5%. And that, generally speaking, once it gets to that level, it becomes prohibitively expensive to continue to borrow money or to roll over debt, and begins to eat into corporate earnings, and begins to, in many cases, like one of the big box stores that reported this week, if their real rise in earnings was only 2%, and their debt that they've been rolling over from month to month, as they tend to do, or every 2 months or every 3 months, increases at another 30% over the next year, they won't have any earnings a year from now. That explains why we saw substantial decreases in stock prices on the big box stores. Now, all that sounds pretty complicated and pretty weird, but before we get too complicated and too weird, we probably do need to take a commercial break, and I need to tell you this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if today is November 17th, where you are, of 2018, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. But what we're going to do is we're going to break for some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out because of an unexpected event that came up last night. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And we were talking about the economy, however you want to say it, and stock prices. And, you know, we went into why the big box stores had sunk in value after they reported their earnings. And things are often on Wall Street not at all what they appear to be. That's kind of an understatement. We saw that in the oil markets. The oil, whichever one you want to look at, Brent has been down more than that. But there's basically two oil benchmarks in the world that are used as standard markers for where the oil market is. And one is West Texas Intermediate, and the other one is Brent Crude. North Sea Brent, I think it's actually. And I go off of West Texas Intermediate because I live in Texas, and who wants to follow a bunch of stuff that's happening in the North Sea anyway? So West Texas Intermediate is down about 25% from its peak, and the peak was in October. That's a heck of a drop. Now, why did it go up and why did it go down? Those are the kind of things that I find absolutely fascinating. Now, that doesn't mean it's down, 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 because it's still up a bunch from last year. And so it like the Treasury, is up a bunch from last year, which you have noticed if you go to the gas station and you buy gasoline. Do we really have gas stations anymore? I don't know. I guess, but we certainly don't have service stations. Anyway, so what happened? This is something that was fascinating to follow. When the president said we're going to impose sanctions on Iran, and we're going not just sanctions, we're going to cut off their oil exports. The oil prices shot up because they looked at the total oil that's coming into the world from everywhere and said Iran's a big piece of that, and there's going to be an oil shortage, and the economy is booming across the world, and everything is going hunky-dory, and the United States is burning more oil every month. And we're going to wind up with an oil shortage. And so the prices started going up, and they went up a bunch, and they're still up. But a couple of things happened. The administration gave eight nations, waivers so they can still continue to import Iranian oil, which means that the Iranian oil embargo is not really an embargo. It's if the Trump administration likes you as a nation, you get to import Iranian oil, and if they don't, you don't. There's justification behind them, but I read the justifications and they seem pretty flimsy. Eventually, those will shut off too. But at the same time, oil has a lag built into it because it takes a while to ramp up production of oil. And so based on the higher price of oil, a lot of fracking wells that had been closed were opened up again because it was now, again, profitable to pump oil out of those wells. And Saudi Arabia and Russia and most of the OPEC nations increased their output. And as a result, now we have a little bit of a glut going on, but I don't know that that's going to go on. As a matter of fact, I don't know what's going to happen next. But this is the kind of thing that goes on, because the shortage from the Iranian oil embargo, which took effect November 4th, hasn't emerged. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, there was adequate production ramped up in a lot of places, which was a bit of a surprise. But the second reason, and this is one of those really crazy things how they interact, was tariffs. The threat of 25% tariff on Chinese goods and the threat of a tariff on all imported automobiles and the existing tariffs on steel and aluminum and a lot of other things that the United States has imposed has slowed the global economy. And once it tips over into the slowing range, it can just continue into the slowing range. And if the 25% tariffs are imposed that the Trump administration has promised at the end of this year, it will distinctly be a physical slowdown in the global economy. Why? Well, because we buy a lot of stuff. And if we raise prices by 25% on all the stuff that we import, and we do import a lot, and by the way, that goes back to the big box stores we were talking about a few minutes ago. One of the reasons their prices fell is uniformly the CEOs of the retailers in the United States warned that if the 25% tariff on everything coming from China were imposed, they would be in a very awkward position. They would either have to raise the prices of their goods and services rather substantially, which would probably result in much fewer purchases of more expensive items, or they would have to eat the difference and possibly go so far as to take a loss on their operations simply because of the 25% tariffs. This caused a lot of caution to go in there. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, if you wanted to, the key to a rally at the end of the year, if the Trump administration were to announce that, hey, we're getting along with China now and then we're going to not do the 25% tariffs on everything imported from China, you would see the stock market jump dramatically. And there's a bit of an irony here. And what's the irony? And by the way, that's also, and you'd also see the price of oil start back up again because the market would conclude that the world economy might recover. Now, when we say recover, let me give you an example. The economic engine that drives Europe more than any other single entity is Germany. Germany just turned in their GDP report for the third quarter, and it was a slight negative number. That is profound. The European Union, the economic zone called the European Union, is either, depending on how you want to measure it, second or third largest entity in the world. The United States as a whole, the European Union as a whole, are approximately the same size economically. And when you have the European Union's number one production machine, which is Germany, report a negative number for its gross domestic product, that means that a lot of commerce won't go on. You think, well, and there might be the immediate reaction, so what if Germany doesn't have a lot of business? Well, the fact is we're in a global economy. And in that global economy, we do sell a lot of things to Germany, and Germany sells a lot of things to us, and there's a lot of monetary exchanges between the United States and Germany and the European Union in general. If the European Union slips into recession again, it will affect the United States economy. It will have a significant effect, not an earth-shaking effect, but a significant effect. Then you throw this in with a couple of other things. Our balance of trade was reported in the last couple of weeks, and it is deteriorating pretty fast. As a matter of fact, there is a certain irony here. The more that the tariffs are imposed on the system, the greater our balance of trade gets out of whack and we wind up importing more and exporting less. Why? Well, because there's counter tariffs that are thrown in there immediately. The other thing is, of course, and we've mentioned this before, a lot of our exports are heavy equipment. Boeing is one of our number one exporter, and so is Caterpillar. Putting a 10% tariff on imported steel effectively raised the price of steel in the United States by about 40% over the rest of the world. Now, I can go into great detail as to why it went up 40%, but suffice to say that the tariff is the key element in causing the price of steel to rise. Caterpillar, if you've ever seen anything made by Caterpillar, it's basically a big chunk of iron with an engine that drives it around and causes it to move things. And mostly it's a big chunk of steel. And that steel has gotten a lot more expensive, and Caterpillar has warned, if this continues, we're going to hurt. We're going to have to start laying people off. We're in a world of hurt here, and we are losing bids to, for example, some of the big competitors that Caterpillar has are in Japan. And for whatever it's worth, a Japanese piece of heavy equipment imported into the United States does not have a 10% tariff on the steel in it. They just get to import the piece of equipment. And you can say, well, let's put tariffs on that too. Well, that compounds the problem. So the issue is that our imports are dropping off. China, for example, was actually a significant importer and a growing importer of items from the United States. Slowly over time, the stuff they were importing from the United States was growing and it was accelerating, and it reversed in the last two quarters, where now we are exporting less to China than we did before. We actually see a negative number in that area. And that is having an effect on the economy right now. If we go to 25% tariffs, if we actually go to 25% tariffs, the market isn't totally prepared for that, and is not happy with it as it sounds right now. And it's not going to be very happy with it any way we approach it. And so all of this stuff is going on at the same time, all of these moving pieces in the economy, and it's kind of important to keep up with this while interest rates are rising. Why are interest rates rising? Well, there's a key element here. The Treasury Department announced this week that the deficit for the month of October was, I wonder if anybody knows what that number is off the top of their head, because it's a nice round number. The deficit for the month of October of the United States was $100 billion. Now, I'm being a bit old-fashioned. Admittedly, there's been a lot of inflation under the bridge since then. But I remember when the Reagan administration was criticized heavily because its total annual deficit was $200 billion. Now, money has roughly doubled because of inflation, and it takes roughly, let's just very round figures, twice as much to buy the same amount as it did during the Reagan administration. So a $400 billion annual deficit is the equivalent of the worst that Reagan imposed when he borrowed a lot of money to get the economy rolling again coming out of the 1982 recession. I say he borrowed. He talked Congress into passing bills, and he signed them. We had a $100 billion deficit in October. Now, are we going to have $100 billion every month? I don't think so, and I don't know. It may be higher or lower. But let's just assume that October is a fairly normal month. And by the way, October normally is a normal month because a lot of people pay their taxes in October who defer on their tax filing. That means we have a $1.2 trillion deficit that we're headed towards in the United States for the fiscal year 2019. Remember I told you that, you remember that I told you earlier that interest rates are going up. The higher interest rates go, the more expensive that deficit gets. And both the CEO of Morgan Stanley and the CEO of Goldman Sachs announced this week that they considered the rising federal deficit and rising interest rates that are being generated by the rising federal deficit to be potentially catastrophic. Matter of fact, one of them referred to it as a suicide. Jamie Dimon referred to it as a suicide pact. The problem is the more money that we borrow on the open market, the higher the interest rate that's going to be charged by the lender. That's just true. The more money you choose to borrow, if you choose to borrow more money than you can immediately pay down, your creditors are going to look at that and they're going to start raising the interest rates that they charge you to borrow that money. And it's true of the United States as well. And as we're borrowing the money, it's forcing interest rates higher, which forces the cost of borrowing the money higher. And frankly, we're headed down the road, maybe several years, maybe not so many years, into a potential crisis over not the ability to pay the debt, not the ability to borrow the money, but the ability to generate enough money in our economy to pay for it. Now, that is an issue. Now, why I say that? There's a certain amount of free money that's out there trying to be invested at any given point. The higher interest rates go, the more likely that money is to go to a safe place where it gets a higher interest rate. When interest rates are low, that money is willing to take, the people who are willing to loan their money are willing to take some risks, and they're willing to buy bonds. They're willing to do that type of thing. Do we have a call?
I didn't want to be on the air, but had a question about cryptocurrency.
Okay, I'll come back to cryptocurrency. John and Temple wanted to my opinion on cryptocurrency. Sure, I will. the issue is we are headed into a potential crisis, and the crisis will resolve itself, they do, but the pain will be felt along the way. The problem is we're borrowing money at a rate that's not sustainable. In other words, the economy is incapable of growing fast enough to accommodate the increased need to loan the government money, which means we're by definition, be dependent upon foreign lenders. Now, here's the issue with that. 5 years ago, 50% of U.S. federal government debt was that's held by the public was held outside the United States. It's now down to 40%. It's not that somebody said, hey, let's sell off a bunch of U.S. treasuries. It's not that the Chinese said, hey, let's sell off a bunch of U.S. treasuries. The issue is that with interest rates rising, the treasuries they're holding that have low interest rates are declining in market value. And so they have a tendency to sell those off. Another thing is that as the global economy starts to slow down, it really isn't slowing at this point, its growth rate is slowing, there is a tendency for governments to want to take some of their money and stimulate the economy and do things within the economy to keep their economies running faster. To do that, they have to have cash, and the world reserve currency is the dollar. The dollar is up. The bonds have slid slightly, but the dollar is up. Because the dollar is up right now, and again, the dollar is up mainly because of tariffs, the tendency is to sell treasuries, take cash, and inject it into their economy or put it into something else. A key element in all of this, and I know I'm feeding you way too much information, but this is what goes through my head on an everyday basis and keeps me thinking and keeps me going. The dollar has risen this year 7% against the Chinese yuan, or renminbi. It's called one or the other, both sometimes. It's risen about a little over 5% against against a basket of world currencies. What that means is, as interest rates rise in the United States and the value of bonds that were bought that have lower interest rate on it decline, but the rise of the dollar is offsetting that, around the world, a lot of investors, and major nations included, are taking a look at this and said, if interest rates continue up and the dollar doesn't, we could lose some money in the future, so let's go ahead and sell off some of those treasuries and take it as cash and go to short term in anticipation of this rising interest rates caused by more borrowing. I know this is far more complex than people like to hear, but there's a lot of moving parts in the economy, and I'm going to get down to the basics of it in just a few minutes, either this hour or next hour. I'm going to answer John's question, and then we can go to commercials, our second commercial break. John wanted to know about cryptocurrency. Really very simple about cryptocurrency. It's pretty much worthless. It's only worth as much as people want to pay for it, and people don't want to pay very much for it. As a matter of fact, it is down in the last 12 months. It's down about 60%, Bitcoin. Yes, there have been hacks into the exchanges, and a lot of them have disappeared, so it's not secure from a physical ownership perspective. It is not secure in that nothing backs it. Nothing backs it. See, the dollar is a cryptocurrency backed by the full faith and taxing ability of the United States, and our Constitution and our Federal Reserve Act say we will pay our debts. Matter of fact, the Constitution doesn't say that the government employees will get paid, but it does say the federal debt will get paid. So cryptocurrencies basically are something that are going to be a passing fad and disappear into the darkness at some point. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, we need to break for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach on KTEM 1400. And the telephone number to call on the other side of the commercials would be 254-773-1400. We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out due to an unexpected event that occurred in his life and his way of doing things. We got about 4.5 minutes left in the radio program today for the first hour. We have a second hour coming up with this on November 17th, 2018. That's today, and next hour still will be today. I've noticed something very consistent is that today remains today no matter what we do. So we were talking about debt a minute ago, and we're talking about the complexities and what I consider the irony that the Trump administration and the Republican leadership in Congress chose to do a couple. Well, the Trump administration chose to raise tariffs. The Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress chose to cut taxes. And very frankly, it's kind of like smoking cigarettes and drinking whiskey at the same time. They have opposite effects on your body, and the end result isn't going to be too terribly exciting in the long term. In the short term, it may make you feel good. The deficit, and Ed asked me at the end of his show as we were switching over in here what I would do were I president. Well, the answer is obviously as president, I don't have the authority to do this. But if I had the power to do so, I would say that we should have lowered corporate taxes to 21%. That's a good number. But we needed to follow suit with what happened in the rest of the world when corporate taxes were lowered, and that is raise personal income taxes. Now, I know all the arguments for not raising personal income taxes. I know that theoretically, if you lower taxes, people spend more money, and they do a little bit for a while, and then they stop. It's what history tells us. But unfortunately, the dollar value, and it just not because I think anybody targeted it that way, but the dollar value of the personal income tax reductions went mainly to upper income people. Okay, remember that. Roll that around in your head for just a second. Why? Well, upper income people pay the majority of income tax in the United States, the vast majority of income tax. The higher your income gets, the bigger percentage that you pay in taxes. You can go up to around $500,000 of joint income. You go up to around 37% income tax, and you lose a lot of your deductions. So the people in the upper tax brackets are paying a lot. The problem with the tax cut as it was enacted is that use this number, that's not what actually occurred, but a 20% tax cut for somebody in the 37% tax bracket who's making $500,000 or $1 million a year is a much bigger chunk of change than it is for the person at the low end of the tax bracket who gets maybe a $30 increase per paycheck for the whole year, which is a lot to them, but it's still doesn't amount to a lot of dollars. In some cases, at the lower stretch of the income brackets, there was no relief from the tax bill. The end result is, and not because I'm not saying that people in upper brackets should be taxed more, our lower brackets should be taxed less or anything else. I'm simply saying that the effect is that most of the tax cut dollars went to people in the upper brackets. And the people in the upper brackets have a tendency not to spend their excess money. They have a tendency to save it, which I guess is a plus in some ways. Well, you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach for this hour. We'll be back again on the other side in the next hour. But if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local telephone number. We do manage investments and investment portfolios, and we do wealth management for people in the higher, generally speaking, $1 million or more portfolio. And it's 254-947-1111 or 800-914-7526. I've got my numbers messed up here. 254-947-1111, or you can contact us at tpwc.com. That's our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And so do I cut off at 10 seconds? Okay. Until next hour, this has been the first hour of The Personal Wealth Coach.